How's that for sound? Oh, that's good. All right.
That's good.
Job, yeah. Forgive me sitting down. I contracted arthritis at the same time I contracted poetry 45 years ago. So, and as I was saying to the B&B people, where I was saying, I'm not sure which has been the most painful. So, if you take my point. So do forgive my seated arena tonight. Lovely to be here. At one point, due to trains and Trans-Pennine, we thought we weren't going to be. We thought we were going to be marooned in Yorkshire, but we've struggled our way here at some point. And I'm also relieved to be not reading in the dark, as those poets referred to there, which would be a bit tricky for me actually, but yeah, very relieved about that. So smashing to be here. I'm going to do a selection of poems tonight, some from what Emily just mentioned there, He's Looking at You Kid, the collection there, and also the other collection I brought out this year, which is Americana. Speaks for itself, really, poems written in the course of Bill and my trip to America last year. And I'm finishing with a couple of sort of French geared poems, so we're going terribly cosmopolitan tonight. I'm going to start with a poem which really, a lot of my inspiration comes from my mum and dad. My dad's family were all from Mayo, and my mum's family were all from Killarney, and they did the magic crossing to Liverpool, so that's kind of my background. And that's pretty much why I feel I write, and why I've been writing for these massive 40, but it sounds a lot when you say that. Sounds like I really should give up. But yeah, for the whole period of time. So my mum and dad have greatly inspired my work. And I often think, was saying to Paul earlier today, I sometimes feel as though you switch on a bit of an Irish head, or even sometimes a bit of an American head when I'm writing. A kind of a voice comes to you. Sounds like I should be having people in white coats come, isn't it? But truly, that's not. I'm allowed to play with things at the shop, really. Yeah. So, well, they tell me I'm anyway. So I'm going to start with the lead poem for this tonight, which is about my dad, really, and the area that I grew up in, which, if you saw a cat with a tail on it, was a tourist. It was quite a lively old area. This is Here's Looking at You, Kid. Well, I noticed from an early age that the sun asked permission to be on our street. Is the sun allowed here? I once asked my dad, and even though he knew it wasn't, he pulled his collar high and looked all around and put it in his pocket just for me. Even though he knew to own this bright, this dangerous thing would bring me peril as well as joy. Better to have a little sun than none at all. And we walked home, he and I, like two happy dogs, and the sky was duck-egg blue, and the grass, it was full of four-leaf clovers. And me dad winked, and we laughed to think that he'd got the sun in his pocket. He's looking at you, kid, Dad said. He's looking at you. Thank you very much. And second poem, really, just to even up the score, even up the balance, is a poem about my mum. She was a very different quality to my dad. She always maintained that she was the spiritual half of the partnership, which I don't quite know how true that was. But he was the storyteller, and she was the one trying to keep things sane when she saw it. But actually, she was a hell of a rebel on the quiet. So she did see part of this poem in the preceding years before she died, I think she was a little bit appalled. It's called My Wild Mother. My mother's at that difficult age, between 81 and 81 and a half. She says she's not a senior citizen, just a citizen. She plays hooky from church bazaars. She borrows my kitten mules and feather boa and hangs round bars in town. She wears gold studs through false teeth. She's had a Lancaster bomber tattooed on her left arm. We won't talk about the right. Men from the over 60s club leave things for her in the porch in plain brown wrappers. She says she's saving chat rooms for the new year after Bruges when she's bored. Did I mention Bruges? There's talk of Bruges for Christmas with Hal, the American that she met at Salsa Class, 64, all his own teeth. She's fitting him in between Lycorden for the man who comes to mend the boiler and shamanic journey to rid herself of life's little obstacles, which is me, apparently. She buys shop cakes recklessly, now she no longer bakes, and my father's allotment has become a figure of fun. She was seen giving the last of its produce to the poor and needy down at the DSS. That's the staff. I can't bring myself to ask why it had to be a lift at the co-op to scatter my father's ashes. She's been banned from the Country Women's Guild for rap dancing and spitting and her talk on voodoo, how it improves your sex life, has been put on an indefinite hold. Everyone says there is no need to worry that they're all the same at that age, that it's just her hormones running amok, and that it's a phase we look back on together and laugh. But the sign on her bedroom door still reads, "Access denied to those not from the planet Zuck." Apparently, if I want to keep her, I have to let her go. It's all very complicated. All I know is her Pericomo collection is in pieces in the bin, and underneath her pillow I found a ticket labelled Bruges. Julius. I think her actual phrase on reading part of that poem was, "Helen, I don't know where you get this rubbish." That was fairly typical. As I said, I'm travelled here very much due to the auspices of my brilliant partner Phil here, who gets me on and off stages all over the place because of this stupid arthritis. And I think you have to have a laugh about these things, otherwise you would go completely dotty and round the bend. So this is me having a laugh about hospitals. Hospital lingo. Well, there's a lot of it about in here, and it always starts with the procedure, which will be carried out whether you like it or not. It makes no odds, you can be watching Deal or No Deal, and they'll still come for you in the hospital for the procedure. It'll be done with a bicycle pump and a packet of Karamak. Then a packet of tweezers and a pair of tweezers, and I'll be smeared all over with a sausage roll. Apparently it's all for my own good. Christine at the end is having everything removed piece by piece. Her sanity, a sense of humour, and the husband. She's quite glad about the last. Another poor sod is having all her bits sewn on, but this time in the right order. Well, the spleen is such an decorative item. We've all been here far longer than we would like. Our visitors, poor limping specimens, come in just to cheer themselves up, and they are free to leave, cocky beggars. I have had mine scraped, flagellated and crimped, then it's been run up a flagpole, and it still works with all the good grace of a banjo with no strings. Maureen at the end has had a pipe put down and a frog inserted, and the dye has spilled out, and the frog is none too happy either. Cynthia in the end bed has had it all twirled around so that the first year medical students could get a really good look at her. Then she was rinsed, parboiled and hollandaise mousse frozen in a time capsule put in a handbag. The woman who tried to be a vicar on the end bed has been Emmanuel and has had the tattoo of Cliff Richard finally removed. She had a vision in the night of Bjorn from ABBA giving her the kiss of life, which is a bit of a worry. The little lass in the side room who's been sectioned keeps on singing "We'll Meet Again, Kathleen," then running naked down to the front doors. Why wouldn't you? She's been nil by mouth since she was born. Anyway, it's an ill wind that blows nobody, because they come in later to tell me it's all going on nicely and the inner tube can be removed in the morning from the arse. And the orangutan that they're going to strap to me chest, and then I've just to see the nurse with me tablets and I can go home. But you know, I've grown quite partial to the place, because they do a lovely bit of fish on a Friday. Thank you, very kind. Yes, I dread that word, procedure. Slightly more serious poem now. I was thinking about medals, really, quite recently, and thinking, should there not be a medal for kindness, you know, for people in the world that are kind? And it kind of just inspired this little poem, the kindness medal. This, then, is a medal for kind people. It was minted in the can't-be-asked-to-be-bothered-with-it factory, and it'll be ignored and not even brought out on special occasions like days you breathe on. And it will be stored in vaults and knockdown shacks and will-o'-the-wisp caves and dust-riddled libraries that nobody, not even Philip Larkin, dare go in. And it will be unsung about and unwritten about, and spiders will weave webs around it, and its colour will fade, and the ribbon that it would have hung from will be lost, and a little gold box it came in will be broken and stood on and splintered, and nobody will know, or worse still, care. And it'll be unremembered in a thousand small ways in every corner of the glib and transient world. This is the Medal of Honour for kind people, and it'll never ever be given to them. I wish it was given to them. I actually do. This poem was very fortunate last year that it won the Torbay Poetry Prize, which I'm sure many of you know of that one. And it was a genuine story, as many poems are when they come to us. A genuine story I wrote. My mum was brought up on a farm. Phil and I are very much city folk. If we get too far from Topshop, we get very nervous. We come out in a rash or something. But she was a country girl. And this is a lovely story that she told me about looking after an old pig on the farm. Quite sadly. The old pig. He was old, you told me. And the pig, I now imagine, hanging sweet as a bag of sugar in the barn. And your job was always to feed him, and him licking your hand as if it were pressed silk. So many times you told me the story, and your guts turning, churning, knowing his future. Brushing the long crease of your skirt as you watched it eat, fat, contented. Turning the iron handle of the sty door, the kind jailer you must have seen, and the sky above the door blue as your eyes, and the straw in his heart stiff with fright on that last day. And both of you willing that day not to come, but knowing it would, when your face turned away to the sky, love and anguish mixed with mud, a bloody cocktail. Every ambush requires that there are two. Your hand on the door, closing it, and the old pig listening for your voice found only silence. Turn his face to the sky, you tell the men. And you replay the ambush many times through all those years, because the pig forgives you endlessly, even as they bring the knife towards him. He forgives you. Thank you. And I'm just going to read a poem now for you that I wrote, really, I suppose, especially for this event. And it's mainly, it's in the main, it is true actually, this one, and it's about my, well, it's self-explanatory really, I suppose. It's called My Irish Christening. And quite a lot of it is true. Most of this did really happen. My Irish christening. It was a very Irish christening, or so I am told. My father arrived late, having been to the wrong church, and demanded that all the names were changed. He decreed I was called Helen, after every American heroine in every American film that he had seen. There was to be no Dimphna or Conceptua here. My mother was wearing her best purple hat with the ostrich feather, and my Aunt Winifred arrived late on a motorbike with a jockey she'd just met. My godfather, Anthony, known as the Wild Man of the Wood because he slept there, recited the Lord's Prayer quite beautifully, and my Aunt Mary Ellen recited from memory, "The boy stood on the burning deck," but nobody knew why. The priest almost got the names wrong and thought he was giving a Latin mass or teaching catechism, until his housekeeper fixed him with one of those Donegal glares. And a man called Kelly blessed a shillelagh and gave it to my dad on my behalf. And little Sean Myers, who was totally dumb, did a dance as it was All Souls Day. and everyone brought tea and soda bread back to me mum's house. And the priest was invited back as an honoured guest and arrived 3 hours late, having been waylaid by a bottle of whiskey. Mum was not speaking to Dad, and Dad was speaking to everyone, which was pretty much how it went for the next 50 years. My christening gown was white with blue stripes, and my mother had made it from a remnant off the market. Aunt Winifred sang Rosa Tralee, and Dad and the priest sang the green and red of Mayo. Sean Myers, the little dumb man, almost spoke twice, and then didn't. And Dad said this whole God business thing was a mystery to him, but by some kind of miracle, I was given a name by crazy people who loved me. I still have the shillelagh, you know, but I don't recall that I ever saw my godfather, the wild man of the wood, ever again. Yes, I don't recall that I ever did. And another poem here, which I just thought might give you a smile as well. It's about that, I don't know if any of you had to sit through the dreaded catechism class as kids, learn by heart, and really drove me crackers and that. But my own excuse for writing this poem was that I always thought that the Holy Spirit was known as the Great Parakeet. Okay. So bearing that one in mind, that was what inspired this one, me at the catechism class. So it was here that I learned that there was a lady called Pina who would be very indulgent to me. And that in the sky there was somebody responsible for it all who was called the Great Parakeet. Any slip-ups, and the priest usually threw a border at me because you must practice all the catechism words 4 times a week. Catechism meant that you would have all the answers in the world and be on first name terms with God and all of his envoys. And apparently it meant that the archangels would help me pass my 11 plus. And that I would be confirmed and given a name like Esmeralda, and the bishop would whack me one on the face. Looking back, Catholicism seemed quite a violent religion. Bit of a prize fighter of a faith. And for a while, it's true, I toyed with Buddhism. But it didn't have the same dramatic conflict or lunacy. So I kept the faith. The one true faith, the X factor of faiths. And I also kept the parakeet in my mum's front room, which, although he was messy, was a hell of an icebreaker. And moving across town really to a poem that I wrote about a man who paints the word hope on bridges in London. Apparently on a lot of bridges around sort of the Camden area, this man just goes around and paints the word hope on bridges. Nobody ever sees him, nobody knows how it gets there, and it so intrigued me when I saw this fact. I thought, well, that's got to be a poem. So this is simply called The Bridges of Hope. Someone is doing it, but no one knows who, and no one knows how, or least of all why. Somebody is painting all the bridges in South London with a single word, hope. And everyone's up in arms. Whole councils are demanding investigations into the lunacy. A man called Des at the council says it depresses him just thinking about it, let alone looking at it. Apparently he lives under one of the bridges. 2 girls who work at the library say it's the only thing that keeps them going on a Monday morning, knowing that hope will be there in purple and gold lettering. But no one knows who is the phantom scribbler. He's never been caught on camera or seen balanced on the ladder. Could it be the Corn Circle folk? Or could it be Arthur Down the Chippy or Arthur's wife, Maeve? The letters are all the same on all 9 bridges, bold and large and curving and rich. Perhaps it's Da Vinci come back from the grave. People are lighting candles and keeping vigil by some of them. People leave roses and flowers and camellias. Children are allowed to stay up late just to see hope by moonlight. And dogs are allowed to bark and run free. And the word on the street is that there is still hope, but it's not done by any human hand. As far as the men from the council, as fast as they can erase it, the word springs back, bigger and brighter and bolder than ever before. People are buying houses that look right onto it, and it's begun to feature in Time Out and the guidebooks. And even last night, the Queen and Prince Philip came down to have a look. 9 bridges, given the scale of things as they stand in the world, it doesn't seem a lot. But right now, let's face it, it's all we've got. Different note, I suppose, or maybe not a slightly different note. I like to think that this poem is a very hopeful poem, and it's a poem called Stretching the Truth. I couldn't rightly tell you what inspired this one. It was just me thinking, I suppose, about having been a poet for this length of time and wondering what the whole deal was. So it's kind of that thing about that whole writer's thing of creativity, that whole buzz, Stretching the Truth. And so, this is a kind of sorcery, this poetry, and with it, I am always stretching the truth. And all the time, it is stretching through my life like a child's skipping rope. And in the playground, they said, hey, sing us a song, tell us a poem, and we'll leave you alone. So I did, stretching the truth like an old tomcat, like a whiskey banana. But there's only certain words now that they want to hear, and they are cavalcade, mellifluous, comrie, Albrosial, artichoke. And they don't want to hear what's happened to the world and to the dreams of men. And so, like a good songbird, you learn not to sing. And all the time I'm stretching the truth. All the time I stretch the truth like the strings on an old banjo sounding to the whinnying dark. And there's only certain words that may be used, and these are quintessential, leverage, eagle-eyed, and the rocket. So I went away to college and I learnt again, and I said groovy and far out, and yes, I love libraries and studying, stretching, stretching, stretching the truth. And of course I know about the 3 other women that you're sleeping with, stretching the truth. And in marriage again we become strange sorcerers. We say, thank you for the birdcage you built me of bricks and mortar. And the words they want to hear now are compendium, amorphous and pepperpot. Not stop the fucking world, I want to get on. Not grievous bodily harm being done to the earth. Not new men fighting the same old wars. And here I am stretching the truth again. Trying not to use words like growing old, growing invisible. Trying not to say frightened of what may or may not come. I am stretching the truth into a bucket. And I'm throwing it far out to sea, wading it out after it. In a boat called infinity, and you and me, kid, riding the waves, and all they want to hear now is bohemian and crustacean and postmodernism and lyrical. Not is there anybody out there, and will no one help the helpless? And all the time, do you know, I keep on stretching that truth around my little finger, around my daft old heart, around your beating soul that begs for freedom like a burnt out star. Until I'm stretched so thin, this songbird, and so weary, I'm like that nightingale, you know, that one that sang in Berkeley Square, till there was no song left in its body and nobody left to care. Stretching and stretching, can you see me now? Stretching the truth. Yeah. As I promised, I'm going to do some poems from the American book just briefly for you. And Phil and I got across there now to Rhode Island, New York, and Chicago last year. It was my first trip across there, and it was really because, as I said to Emily, because my dad ended up, we're from York, and he would desperately like to have ended up in New York. So it was kind of a trip in, an homage, I suppose, in memory for him, because he never got there. And he never got there because a letter, which mentioned in this poem, a letter never arrived for him. And this is about that letter. The letter that never came for the old song and dance song. Well, it was always that letter. The one that he remembered, the one that never came, the one that said, come, Billy, come to America. It said, everything you've ever dreamed is there, so come. Uncle Patrick and Aunt Rosa grounded, the baby's fit and well and strong, God be praised. Can you believe we even have somewhere to live here? And Ma has a job at the bakery. Ah, she'll be rich in life here, and the days Oh, the days are a sight warmer and the nights, they don't fill you. Now you can be bought here and you to the land, so come. The letter that never came for the old song and dance man. The letter you always remembered opening, Dad, you would have opened it in a heartbeat, in a second, like a magician, like a man with a future, like a man with look on his side and a song in his heart, doing the soft shoe shuffle in a place called Brooklyn. So there are so many of our own here, Billy, but it's as if they seem to know us, to understand us, that all we want is a place to lay our heads and our dreams. Can you believe it, Billy? I'll believe it. There is a place you can walk tall in and not be short of a bob or two. Oh, the boat coming over, that was another matter, sure I thought. Patrick was a goner. It took all of our strength, Kilmartin and the lads, to see him through. Sometimes the worst of a storm is both terrible and necessary and has to be gone through. And that is where you find us now, on the other side of the storm. Kilmartin and Ma and Rose and the kiddies and myself, Johnny Burke, and your uncle Patrick Rowan. Just think of it every day now, Billy, and I'm sending you this letter as promised. Leave all of that other nonsense behind. You were made for this country, and it for you. So pack nothing except your hopes and your dreams you stand up in. And we'll be waiting right where the storm ends and freedom will shake your hand. Ma says, by the way, 'tis a grand life if you don't weaken. So come, Billy, come to America. He would have gone in a shop. It's one of those strange quirks of fate, really, that the letter went to every house apart from my uncle Patrick Rowan's house. So Phil and I wandered erstwhile around America, and I wanted to see John Lennon and the Imagine area there. So we went across there, and then a lady said to us, well, we were at the Imagine Memorial, of course, across the way is where John got shot. So we moved across to there. And this is about the man who was on the door there. The John Lennon doorman. Well, he's savvy. He's smart as a whip, this guy, and savvy. And he's got gypsy eyes and a sucking mouth that chews gum. And he's stood in now for long, far too long, too many hours. A minute in New York is a year in anybody's language. And we ask him, excuse us, is this where it happened? Is this where they shot Lennon? And the words freeze in the air, and he chews the gum real slowly, and he adjusts his gold buttons with the arrogance of a lord, and he checks his reflection in his shoes. On the anniversary day, he makes sure he ain't there. He says, see, I'm in a band. I've been in a band all my life, and my wife, she's an actress, and yet nobody comes here asking about her. So they shot some guy. This is New York, what you were expecting. This ain't no Disneyland. This ain't no picnic in the park. And his breath freezes in the air above his head. And the flames behind him burn real high, like a gold message left by some guy. And you and I shiver, and I ask you for my gloves. And we walk really fast. We walk on. This is my very quick take on many aspects of America. I do apologise to Emily and everybody. Just a few dollars more, because everywhere we kind of went in New York, because I utilised a wheelchair going round, I could catch all the phone conversations that everybody was having, and a lot of them were about money, so that's what inspired this poem. A few dollars more. Fearing the dangerously warm burden of the night, where the freeway meets the interstate, small flying creatures are landing in my hair. I get up, I brush them off, I get up, I brush them off, they come back. The shadows of the game go on all night. You say, don't be afraid, there's no reason to be afraid, there ain't nothing out there except the night, which is exactly my point. A woman in the next door room is screaming and screaming. She called out for a bagel, for a different man, for the moon, for a few dollars more. Yeah, I tried that one too. Anything to take away the lousy pain. Then suddenly we hear a knock like the knock of hell, like the knock of Hades on her door. Hey, it seems like they brought her the bagel. Written on Rhode Island, and I think it was the night that we—I think it was the night before we came back, actually, Americana Pizza, and we were desperately looking for something to eat on Rhode Island. Tonight we eat pizza like wolves, mad, bad, wild, and dangerous to know wolves, English wolves, and behind us lies Providence and the almost full moon, and it puts on a show, and the rainbow edge of the houses splinters against the water and it takes our breath away. Young couples along the bay are discussing Plato and whether to call their first baby Antoinette or Sharina. The girl in the petrol station serves 2 dozen condoms to a guy on a skateboard and she says to us, Oreo cookies? Hell, I got a brother-in-law black as they. When we walk back along the bay, you and I, the pizza, it growls in its box like a haunted owl, like a werewolf in drag, like an ocean of all new words left in a lover's mouth. And you and I, we run like crazy people, like wolves, and we howl and howl and howl up at that pizza moon. The last American one that I will do then, picture my dad in this book. As you can see, he was a shy, retiring person. This is a poem called Better Late Than Never, and this was written again in America, and it was me visualizing the fact that he actually came with us on the trip. Better Late Than Never. Well, my dad is packing his suitcase for America, and nothing I will say will stop him. But Dad, I say, you're dead. Just how you plan to do this. And he counters with, quick as ever, quick as a brown fox that outsmarts the hounds, sure, a little thing like being dead never stopped me before. When I was young, as you know, nothing stopped me. When I was young and foolhardy, nothing stopped me. When I was young, foolhardy and Irish and poor without it being, nothing stopped me. You're too easily deflected. Try and see death as just another stamp in your passport. And he continues with his packing. His old brown razor, the little steel comb, his dancing shoes, the suit from Dublin, and the hat Aunt Sarah bought him. And the picture of his wedding day stood with Mam and the whole of their life ahead of them. In they all go to the suitcase, and truth to say, he is ready way before me. And it seems he is right, because when we get to New York, they recognise him straight away. And they welcome him in like a long-lost ghost. We expected you a few years back, Billy, but no matter, and in he goes, and the fact we are with him stands us in great stead, and we are treated like royalty. We look for him after customs, and we see, there he is, telling stories to a group of mucky-faced kids near the exit. Yeah, I'll see yous later, he shouts. I'm to see a man downtown about a film part, and then Kelly and myself are going downtown to see a couple of bars and a whole lifetime of dreams with our names written on. And with that, he is gone, quick as a flash into the New York air. And so at last, with the sun shining down, my father finally made it to America, being young and foolhardy and Irish and poor and even dead. No, none of this could or dared to have stopped him. Just think of death, he shouts, as another stamp on your passport. Which is just one that people seem to like.
Make the last one?
Yeah, okay. In that case, I'll make this the last one. a poem about, very specific in Albury Streams, a poem about Paris. Never a city that I thought would get under my skin, but it did, and it has, and Phil and I dearly love it. And given recent events, I'd like to conclude with this poem. When it rains in Paris, when it rains in Paris, there is a certain sound that the heart makes, and you do not want to be anywhere else. The stained glass bloom of the lights in the Seine, they count for everything. And the river becomes the universe, and Paris becomes the universe, and you become Paris. This is the day you will remember when eternity calls, when the turning of the little clockwork hours is finally over. The day you walked by the Seine and held its beauty in your two hands, and the cool water ran clean through you, your bones, your muscles, your blood, your very heart. And you wore your robe of flowers and you rode the carousel horse one last time. And the Seine was a quickening knife turning in your heart. And you were a small boat whose fate it was to be on this river at this moment, just as the world ends, ceases to be. What then, you ask? Why, with Paris, you become the stars, little dragonfly poet. You who were alive for just this one hour, remember? And I would have it no other way. Let your poor heart ache. Let your heart break. Let the world end for me now. Let me lie in the glittering arms of the Seine. And when the curtain falls on me one last time, let it be in Paris.
Let's give Helen another round of applause. Yay.